Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, this is Stonewall Live. Stonewall Live, the best of gay and lesbian book, film, and media talk on Blog Talk Radio. Tonight I have Perry Brass, author of 16 books. That's 1-6. A great number of books. Perry's been involved in the gay movement since 1969 when he co-edited Come Out, the first gay liberation newspaper. In 1973, with two friends, he started the Gay Men's Health Project Clinic, the first clinic for gay men on the East Coast, still surviving as New York's Callan Lord Community Health Center. We're going to talk about his latest book, King of Angels, but some of his other books are Carnal Sacraments, The Substance of God, A Spiritual Thriller, and The Manly Art of Seduction, How to Meet, Talk, and Become Intimate with Anyone. Perry, good evening.
Hi, it's really wonderful to be here with you.
Thank you. What, did you love my little intro, Do You Want to Know a Secret?
Yes.
I stole that from his back cover, and I had that on my iPod. So, Perry, thank you so much. I had so much fun. When you sent me this book, I looked at the cover and started laughing. We'll talk about the cover later, but tell me, how much of this book was autobiographical, first of all?
Well, that's a wonderful question. People just immediately ask this question for several reasons. One of them, of course, is that I am from Savannah, Georgia. I am a Southern Jew. The book takes place in Savannah, the city that I was born and grew up in and finally left at the age of 17 when I realized I was gay. And as I tell people, I decided at that point that the best thing that could happen to me still living in Georgia at this period would be I would not be murdered. And I decided that these kind of stakes just would not make my life there worth living, so I left. The thing that's very real about the book are all the feelings in the book, the feelings of not fitting in, the feelings of experiencing real bullying, real violence from other kids, the feeling of falling in love at a very early age, like the hero, the protagonist in the book, Benji Rothberg, he falls in love at 12, and I certainly remember doing that. The closeness of the father and the son, there's an autobiographical emotional tie there because of my own father and my feelings about my own father, who was such a very different person than certainly most Jewish fathers and certainly I think the fathers of most gay sons, in the fact that my father and I had many things in common and many things not in common. He was a Southern Jew. He was born in Charleston.
Wow.
My mother was born in Savannah. And he combined being a Southern gentleman and a Jewish guy. He
wow.
spoke fluent Yiddish. He loved what we call in the South hunting and fishing. Not common with Jewish men to like hunting and fishing, I'll tell you. And he was not, like money oriented. He wasn't, like chasing after dollars all the time. His happiest moments were being with me or his family or hunting and fishing and being with his buddy, wonderful friends. So that closeness between the father and the son, that emotional tie that's in the book, that is very much my story. But the actual story that I tell in the book is not my story. I was not the child of a mixed marriage. I did not grow up in a big white house in the beautiful suburb of Isle of Hope, which is a real suburb of Savannah. I did not go to a Catholic school ever. I had Catholic friends, but I did not go to a Catholic school. So those things are fictionalized, but many of the people in the book, they had real protagonists in my own life. I mean, they were people, are certainly kids that I remembered in some form, and my tie to them I remember in some form in my real life.
Amazing, amazing. Well, I could tell that there were real emotions. I mean, there were incredible emotions, especially with your father. But you know, stereotypes and all that being put aside, you've got four communities in King of Angels, and I'm sure growing up in the South, as you did, you were living in these four communities. You know,
yes.
Southern Jews, which is a whole yes/no dichotomy, black white.
Yes.
You have the African American community during
yes.
the civil rights struggle, during
the
peak of the civil rights struggle. You're right in the middle of the marches, the sit-ins, the
right.
the some of the burnings, things like that. You've got
right.
the Catholics in there.
Right.
I'm laughing. I'm sorry. I shouldn't laugh at Catholics. So you've got Catholics. You've got in 1960, of course, they weren't in any flux. They're just kind of like a big stick in the stream. But really, you have the Catholic community kind of sitting there, and then you have the gay community, and you talk about in the book kind of an emerging gay community, maybe not emerging, but kind of surviving gay community, their own underground, their own people, places to
yes.
meet, how to speak, things like that. So you have all these woven together, sometimes in the same chapter.
Yes. Or,
is this what was going on in your mind all the time growing up, or did you structure it that way?
Savannah's an interesting city, and people have talked about this in the fact that it's a port city.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very conservative city. When I was growing up, it was the center of the Conservative Party of Georgia. Atlanta was considered too liberal and too Yankee-fied
mm-hmm.
to be a place where, even though it was the capital, to put the Conservative Party there. So it's a
mm-hmm.
very conservative city, but it's also a very arty city. It's a beautiful place, and people
mm-hmm.
who go down there are always knocked out by how beautiful it is.
Mm-hmm.
So it attracted arty people and artistic people, and there were artists there, and there was kind of an arty crowd. And when you have that, then you also have a gay crowd. And there was this interesting kind of coalition, I guess you'd say, between oftentimes people who came from old Savannah money and young gays. They would hire the young gays to be their decorators, to be their men about town. I mean, you had the old ladies with the young gay friends. You had that kind of thing. And so certainly by the time I was 16 years old, I realized this was going on.
Uh-huh.
I realized it earlier, but it was one of those things you could never admit. It was always kind of like in denial.
Uh-huh.
But I knew that there were people who were certainly men who I found fascinating, who were stylish, who were seductive, I will say that. They paid attention to me. And it was also in the South where, and I talk about this in The Manly Art of Seduction, where in the South, seduction is always a major art form. And people just
right.
normally relate to each other in this way.
Yeah.
And I go into that theme of seduction in King of Angels also.
You do, because you talk. I think one of the protagonists has a relationship with an older young man named Nathan, which is my name.
Yeah.
And, so I always read those parts. No, I read. Yeah. I read the whole book. I'm just kidding.
Uh-huh.
And he says that he's very seductive, and Benji is shocked because
yeah.
at age 13, I believe it was 13 when he's told that, he didn't even know what that meant.
Of course not.
Well, yeah, you're right. You wouldn't know what the word seduction meant,
right.
even though you've been using it.
Yes.
Yet, that is something that, in the age of Grindr and the physical fascism that the gay world has, that we don't even use anymore. I had not heard, until you started speaking about seduction just in that, I hadn't thought of that word in ages.
Ah, well.
Really? No.
Well, a lot of guys are thinking about it now because they're reading my book. I know
yes,
that.
I would hope so. It's the name of the book. That was the name of your other book that we'll talk about in a minute. But, yeah, it's kind of amazing. It was kind of like you're right. There is that is what's missing is that and maybe the genteel South will bring it all back, is that we have lost the manly art of seduction. We have a
well,
profile
picture.
Go ahead.
It was very much a part of my growing up.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't so aware of it growing up because it was simply a part of the environment you were in.
Uh-huh.
The environment you were in where people would pay attention to you, they would compliment you, they would, even as a small child. And this is something that I miss now very, very much. I was going to say, even as a small child, adults would get down to my level. They would, like, stoop down to my level and say, you know, like, what's your name? And I'd say Perry, and they'd say, God, that's a beautiful name. What a good-looking young man you are. And this is the way people act in the South with kids, at least they did when I was a child.
Uh-huh. Right.
And
right.
I miss that now. I find it terrible that we don't do that with kids in the idea of just simply giving them attention. Now, if you pay any attention to a kid, people immediately decide you're a pedophile.
Right.
But that was simply part of the environment of growing up in the South. And I do talk about that in The Manly Art of Seduction. And I think that it plays into King of Angels also.
Oh, I think it does very much.
Yes.
Good. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun. Tell me how you got to the title King of Angels, because that's a whole other, you know, it took a while for me to figure out how that happened. When did you title the book, at the beginning or the end, and how did you get there?
I decided that I wanted to have the title before I had the book.
Mm-hmm.
I love, this is really weird for a gay Southern Jew, but I love Christmas music. And every time I would hear "Come All Ye Faithful," there's that part about Jesus is born the King of Angels.
King of Angels, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when I would hear that line, I found it very transportive. It was like the idea that this figure of Jesus is the King of these wonderful, I want to say, creatures we call angels. And I think that as a gay man, I find angels fascinating. And I think a lot of other gay men are fascinated by angels.
Yeah,
I wrote a book called Angel Lust that came out in 2000, which talks about gay affinity towards angels.
Uh-huh.
And the idea that, you know, you have these people, these creatures who can appear among us, and that's the way they are in the Bible when suddenly angels pop up, you know, among humans. And they suddenly pop up, and they have these magical qualities. Well, I think that growing up the way I did, I found other gay men to be like that, especially when I was still a teenager.
I see. So your mentors or aunties, which we would call them aunties in the Midwest, I'm from Kansas.
Yeah.
You know, you're the older gentleman who, not gentleman, sometimes just an older friend who just popped in and said, no, you're not doing it right, or something like that.
Well, sometimes they were older, but sometimes it would be like just suddenly in the middle of, you know, like you could be in the middle of a party, and I remember this very much as a young man in my 20s, you'd be in the middle of a party, and it may be even a quote, straight party, and somebody would approach you and you'd have that gaydar thing going,
mm-hmm.
and you'd recognize each other.
Right.
And there's this same, it's like a biblical quality in itself. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, in the Bible, an angel would appear and a figure would realize he is an angel.
For me.
And
right.
I feel that way about other gay men. They had that wonderful performance group in San Francisco called the Angels of Light.
Mm-hmm.
That was really well named.
Yeah, yeah. And you actually moved to San Francisco as a very, very young man. How old were you?
Well, I'm now 65, but I lived in San Francisco when I was 18, yes.
A young man. That 18 is young. I'm almost 62, so I understand. So that was like every gay man's dream when, you know, when I was 16, 15. I said, move to San Francisco, summer of love, I'll be there, everything will be perfect. And, of course, I never made it. I went to New York instead for a few years and came back to
San Francisco was never Neverland then, I will say that.
Sure, sure, sure. There was that. So what year was that, if I may ask?
Oh, that was in 1965.
So that was pre-Stonewall.
Yes, it was pre-Stonewall, yes.
But it was still kind of summer of love hippie. The hippie and flower children were just emerging. Is that correct?
Yes, yes, you're very right. It was, they were, but there was this open, I would say, certainly for the rest of America, an open gay community.
Right.
And that was wonderful to me. That was right. really amazing.
Right, right. There is a sliver of time, and it's a sliver, trust me, where, you know, where gay people had this wonderful coming out experience without the specter of HIV or a politicalization of an anti-gay movement. You know, and in that sliver, you've got some incredible literature that I believe will make a resurgence someday. So, okay, back to my crazy question.
Okay.
What's your favorite gay author?
Oh.
Besides yourself.
My favorite gay author. I have several authors that I would say my favorite gay author is. I like Samuel Delaney a lot.
Oh, so do I, yes.
Chip Delaney.
Uh-huh.
I love Isherwood. I like there are a bunch of younger people that I have read and I've liked. The author that I always feel that I'm closest to as a writer is D.H. Lawrence.
Really?
And I feel like he is so queer. He's totally queer. I'm just stunned that they don't just simply put him in that list. Mm-hmm. I would put him in the list of gay authors very much.
Very homoerotic. I believe you're right. You're exactly right. That question came from our chat room. I get a lot of these questions. Let's talk about the Manly Art of Seduction for a while. What brought you to write that book, The Manly Art of Seduction?
I decided to write that book because so many young men were coming up to me and complaining. These were guys in their 20s and in their 30s, and they were saying they can't meet guys. They don't know how to approach them. They don't know what to say to them. They find most guys their own age so cold, so withdrawn, trying to act so cool, putting on a facade they couldn't understand. What should they do? I also found guys who were slightly older, let's say in their 40s, who were saying that they were scared. They were no longer young. They didn't know what to do about that. They didn't know how to approach other men.
Mm-hmm.
And I started thinking, I've never had a problem with that. Approaching other guys has never been a problem with me. I mean, there are times that this is not to say that I don't have my own fears of rejection. Everybody does, that I never get nervous. But basically, I've always felt like, why not just try to make this as much fun as possible?
Mm-hmm.
If it has to be so nerve-wracking, I don't want to do it.
Right.
You know,
right.
If I feel like talking to someone is just impossible, who wants to do it? Let's make it fun.
Correct. Exactly right.
So I started writing the book about 5 years ago, and I spent about 6 months writing it. And then I thought, I don't want to publish this book. It was just not the right book for me to publish at the time. And I was just kind of sloughing it off and thinking, I'll just do this as a goof. And then I thought, I published, I think, two other books. And then I went back to the idea and I thought, you know, this is a much deeper, more personal and beautiful topic than I had thought. That there are things about this topic that really reach into the deepest part of human beings. And I wanted to put that in the book.
It's good. Let's talk about the big plug here. You can get Perry's books by going to his website at perrybrass.com. PerryBrass.com. And you can also get them at Barnes & Noble. Let's talk about that.
Well, unfortunately, Barnes & Noble is not stocking my books, these two books. For years, I had no problems getting my books into Barnes & Noble. But they're having problems, as everybody knows. They are really contracting their gay lists. The buyers who are buying gay books have gone into this thing where they're stocking like very strange books. One thing I've noticed in New York is that the gay areas seem to be filled with lesbian novels.
Yes.
And I'm thinking that the people, the straight men are buying the lesbian novels, or else they're thinking straight men are buying them. But I have several gay writer friends who, they can't get their books into Barnes & Noble.
Right.
My friend Charles Rice Gonzalez, who put out a book called Chulito.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't get Chulito into Barnes & Noble.
Oh, my God.
They will order the book if you ask for it, and they will stock the book if you ask for it. So I want to get people to ask for it at Barnes & Noble. So ask for King of Angels, ask for The Manly Art of Seduction, and, you know, maybe they'll, you know, get smart and start putting those books in.
That's good. Go ahead.
The books are also available at gay bookstores, and I love gay bookstores. So if you have a gay bookstore near you, please go to your gay bookstore.
And buy two books. And buy two books.
Yes. Yes, really.
We're losing them so fast. It's scary.
Yes.
I
love Giovanni's Room in Philadelphia.
Right.
There's a bookstore in New York called Rainbows and Triangles, which is like our last gay bookstore, I think, basically.
Right. We lost ours here. I know, it's sad. And we're going to talk about when you talk about some of the younger writers. I do, in my work with the Stonewall National Museum and Archives and this show, I come in contact with a lot of very, very young writers, 20, 20-year-olds, who have published books, of course. The self-publishing phenomena, scourge, tornado, hurricane, whatever you want to call it, has kind of democratized publishing, but it's also made it very weird because tell me what you think about it.
Well, I think that the thing about self-publishing is that what most people don't understand is that to begin with, some of the greatest books ever published were self-published. I mean, let's just get this right out in the open. Mark Twain's he self-published him, you know, his later books, Remembrances of Things Long Past, you know, Marcel Proust's great novel. He self-published the first volume of that. Gertrude Stein, she self-published. Ezra Pound published. I mean, all these people. James Joyce, he self-published.
Mm-hmm.
And Whitman, of course, self-published. Whitman was the original self-publisher.
Correct.
So self-published books have always been around. The thing that's a killing situation is that people think it's an easy way out.
Oh, my God.
And it can't be. I mean, if you're going to publish your own books, then you should have a professional editor who edits the books. They should be well-designed. My books are published through Bellevue Press, which is a press that actually my partner owns. When we first started putting out books, I had already been in the book world, in the gay publishing world, for like 20 years. So I had a lot of ins with it, and I kind of knew what it is to put out a very professional-looking book. That has always helped me. I'm very proud of being a self-published writer. I really am. But I'm not proud of a lot of the dreck I see out there.
Dreck is a good word. I call it other things when I get two or three a week in my mailbox from people, and I have gently told people that the grammar structure, and I couldn't figure out what the book was about sometimes. And of course, I never hear from them again. But there are wonderful authors out there that are self-publishing because of the contraction. I'm going to share with the audience, which I've shared before. Perry is not making a ton of money on his books. I mean, the you don't make millions of dollars unless you're the woman who writes Harry Potter or you know, Snooki. Those are the people making.
Well, I mean. Gay books, I mean, I think if you're going to publish for this particular community and market, you're doing it because you really love it.
Exactly.
And if you don't love it, then I don't know what you're doing there.
I mean,
even people like my friend Edmund White, who's a just, you know, wonderful gentleman, Ed is having a hard time selling his books. And
his books get
reviewed in the New York Times. But, you know, we are having a contraction in publishing. And the other thing that's happening is we're now starting to get a number of smaller gay presses like Lethe Press, that's published by my friend Steve Berman, Chelsea Station Press, which is published by my friend Jameson Currier. I mean, these two guys are wonderful. They're very sweet guys.
And Don Lethe,
they're putting out a lot of books. I mean, I don't know how they're putting out so many books.
And Don Lethe, do you know Don?
I'm sorry?
You know
Don
Lethe,
yes. His is...
Magnus.
Right, Magnus Press. The thing about this stage of queer publishing is that going with a smaller press like this is basically one step away from self-publishing, because you will have to do 90% of the promotion,
right?
And God knows how much of the marketing,
right?
The difference between what happens with one of those books and what happens with self-publishing, it's very thin. We're getting very thin now.
Sure. And you have to do the social networking and have your website.
Yes.
And have your chat rooms and have your forums,
right?
And all the things that they didn't teach you in lit school, in English literature school. Yeah, exactly. No, I know. So I'm just going to repeat that with my little plug here. PerryBrass.com, PerryBrass. Or Bellevue Press. Does Bellevue Press have its own website, BellevuePress.com?
No, it's basically PerryBrass.com.
PerryBrass.com.
I'm also on Facebook. I'd love for people to friend me on Facebook if you're hearing this.
Right, and you can talk to... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I would say I'm Twitter-fied, so you can follow me on Twitter. A lot of people do. I'm trying to think what else. I'm on Goodreads and, Shelfari and these kind of things. So I am trying to get out there.
Really, it is. I love Goodreads. I really love Goodreads. I have some of the I get some of the strangest referrals, and I love the books. I'm a book reader, so I love Goodreads.
Wonderful.
Goodreads is a great book. Okay, advice to a young gay author.
Well, first, read a lot. I mean, I always say that the word for writers who don't read, they're called bad writers.
Read
a lot.
Can I use that?
Yes.
Can I have that?
You can have that.
I'll quote you, but I'm going to use that again, okay?
Yes, please do.
Thank you.
Read a lot. Don't try to do something because everybody else is doing it. The world, I swear, does not need one more gay vampire book.
Oh, please, yes.
I've seen so many gay vampire books. I don't even know. There are more gay... Why? I have no idea why. It doesn't need one more gay vampire book. For a while, there was a whole rash of gay Harry Potter-esque books that came out. They all flubbed terribly. Several of my friends who are actually serious writers decided, I'm going to make money and do a gay Harry Potter book.
Sure.
They just fell apart. So don't do something like that. Also, don't feel like you've got to just jump into writing a book. I think that, I know everyone thinks, I've got to get the novel out. You really don't. What you need to do is learn how to write. And I think the best way to do that also is go into something like journalism. Become a journalist for a while. Learn the fundamentals of putting together a piece, of pacing, of where the action is. This is something that most people don't know, but one of the ways I actually learned how to write was writing porn. I was in my mid-20s, I went to work for a straight pulp porn house that put out straight pulp magazines. And I had a gay editor who was wonderful, and I was getting paid, what was at that point a nice amount of money to write straight porn. But what I learned was the importance of pacing, the importance of saying a lot in very few words, importance of not using the same words over and over again.
Right, I've seen that. Listen,
so
we've got 15 seconds to go. Believe it. Was this the fastest 30 minutes of your life or what?
It's been wonderful. It's been marvelous.
And I want to thank you. Go ahead.
That's my advice to a young author.
Great. Listen, Perry, thank you so much. Have fun at Pride this weekend.
And thank you.
Good night from Fort Lauderdale. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Good night.